Hi, this is Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling and games and storytelling in games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I am Max Folkman. Today's guests are Matthew Burns and Carrie Patel. Matthew is a writer, composer, and game developer, and has worked on such titles as Call of Duty United Offensive, Call of Duty 3, Halo 3, ODST, Reach, and Halo 4, Destiny, The Infinite Factory, The Arboretum, The Writer Will Do Something, and TIS 100. Carrie is a narrative designer at Obsidian Entertainment and has worked on Pillars of Eternity, which was recently nominated by the WGA for Outstanding Achievement in Video Game Writing. She's also a writer of fiction, with The Buried Life and Cities and Thrones being her two latest releases. Welcome, and thank you two for coming.
Thank you.
Yes, it's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
So, we'll start off first with just how you two broke in. So, Matthew, if you would like to regale us with how you got into video games.
Sure. I had a few jobs right out of school doing various sort of creative things. I was a sound designer for a while at a music equipment company, and I was a web designer for a while, back when web design just meant like kind of doing HTML stuff. And I was interested in games. I wanted to get into games, but I didn't really know anybody there. I was in Los Angeles at the time, so I just showed up at Activision one day and applied for a job as a tester. So I started in the test department at Activision, which is, funnily enough, literally in the basement of the building. They put the testers in the basement. And wow. Yeah, and that's how I got my start in games.
How'd you go up from tester?
So occasionally jobs become available in the organization for production, and I decided to apply to a couple different production jobs, and the production job that I got was a production coordinator on Call of Duty United Offensive, which was the expansion pack to the original PC Call of Duty, which started the whole thing.
Yeah. And you moved on eventually to becoming producer, right?
That's right, yeah. So then I became a producer, and I went to Bungie, and I worked on Halo for a while, and then it gets really complicated. I left Bungie and I went to Microsoft, and then I left Microsoft and I went back to Bungie. There's a lot of different things that happened. It's a long story.
And when did you start writing?
So I've been writing for a really long time. I guess when I started really sharing it was in about 10 years ago, in 2006, I started this blog called Magical Wasteland. Originally, it was anonymous because I was working at Bungie at the time, and I thought I couldn't talk about what was going on at work very much. So I decided to keep it anonymous. And I've been writing blogs, and then I started writing articles for publications and stuff. And then I started concentrating more on the writing. And so now I'm writing a lot more now.
And Carrie, how did you break in, and tell us about your history with writing?
So, I mean, I'd been working as a novelist and a fiction writer before I got hired in the games industry. I'd actually spent a couple of years trying to focus on getting some of my books traditionally published. And after a while, I thought, you know, I need to work on something else. I need to, you know, I don't think just being a novelist is really a great fit for me. And so I'd always enjoyed games, and I'd always been interested in the storytelling side of games. And so I started looking around at different studios that were a bit more narrative focused and trying to see if any of them had openings. And sure enough, Obsidian was looking for a contract writer at the time. And this was, I believe, in the fall of 2013. So they were looking for someone specifically for Pillars. So I thought, oh, well, I'll apply. Why not? And I did. I took their narrative design test. And then my husband and I were actually on vacation in South Africa when I got an email back from Obsidian saying, we'd like to do a phone interview. Are you available at these two dates next week? And I was thinking, we'll be on the road then. But, you know, sure, we'll find a place with a phone. So I just said, yes, we'll do it. Just can I call you? And so the way timing worked out, it was midnight for us in South Africa, and we were staying in this little ostrich farming town called Oudtshoorn, and we made sure to find one of the hotels that would have good phone connections, got a phone card, and at midnight just went down to the lobby, since I wasn't going to be able to make that call from our room, used the hotel phone and dialed out to California. and did my phone interview from the lobby of the hotel.
Wow.
So yeah, I got the offer a few days later, and it was a full-time offer. And I think spent about a day packing after we got home, and then 2 days driving down to California and started work.
Can you say what the narrative design test was like?
It was a variety of tasks. I think part of it was they just sort of wanted to see what kind of what your philosophy was about narrative, like, you know, what start thinking about narrative, like what games have you liked, what games have you disliked from a narrative perspective, and how would you fix those things? And then there were a few sample tasks that were similar to the kind of writing you would be doing in the game. So, you know, dialogues and quest lines and item descriptions, just to see how you'd handle those.
Okay. Do you want to do writing process?
I want to first, before we go to writing process stuff, I want to ask, like, what does an ostrich farm look like?
Pretty big, actually. We went through one of them. You could actually ride the ostriches. We did not do this, but it was apparently an option. But yeah, they might have had some emus there as well. It was pretty cool.
So, what is your actual writing process like? Matthew, you can go first.
I guess it depends on what I'm writing. I used to not outline at all. I used to just start writing. But lately I've been thinking more about structure, especially as the things that I've been writing start getting longer and longer. You really get into trouble, or you can get into trouble if you don't think ahead when you're trying to put something together that's a little bit larger and more ambitious. So I do end up kind of outlining, whether, you know, especially in the case of when it's a longer thing, but even small things now, I kind of jot down notes and kind of that ends up being my outline, and I sort of bash them into shape, and I cut a lot of stuff as well, you know, start with just a bunch of jottings and then kind of figure out where things connect together and pull those into a thread and then flesh those out and then kind of leave the other stuff.
What made you switch from not outlining to outlining? Did you just get burned from, like,
yeah, absolutely. Rest completely hating myself for not outlining and not knowing where something is going and really getting into trouble, and it's realizing it's completely my own fault. So yeah.
When do you write? Is this for writing for work, or is this your own writing?
My own writing is I write in the evenings. I've read that you're supposed to write in the mornings, like you're supposed to get up really early and write in the mornings. I guess I don't do that. Yeah, most of my writing, because it's not for work, obviously, when I'm writing at work, I just write whenever I'm at the office. But at home, it's usually in the evenings.
Okay. And Carrie, what's your writing process like?
I'm also a big outliner. I think more than anything, I just know that I get kind of stressed out if I don't know where a story or even a chapter is going. And I feel like it comes through in the writing, like it, you know, tends to be lots of long, vague conversations about nothing and characters wandering around looking for something to do. So I really like to have some kind of outline in place, even if I'm going to change it in the course of writing. I think that direction is really motivating and can help me find some of the more interesting conflicts and plot points. I do my personal writing. I'll usually try to do an hour or two in the morning before work. I'll usually take my lunch break outside and do another hour in the middle of the day. And then I'll do some more writing after work. And then obviously, you know, the stuff for work is during the day in the office.
Yeah.
That's so disciplined. I wish I could do that.
I think the terror of contracts and deadlines with my last book really whipped me into shape quite a bit. And I've found that for me, productivity begets productivity. And so, you know, the worst is if I'm not making time and waiting for the writing just to feel right, I will be waiting for a very long time. But like if I have, you know, a day where I hit 1,000 words or I hit 1,500 words, I'm really happy. And then the next day I want to do it again. And just, I think I found that the more I just keep going and keep hitting a good word count, the easier it is for me to keep that up.
Yeah. Momentum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So do you have a word count goal for every day? Or is it just like, see how much writing you can get done?
When it's the drafting phase, I like to hit at least 1,000. I keep telling myself I'd like to work up to 2,000 a day, but that hasn't happened yet. So I try to be happy with, 1,000 to 1,500 sometimes.
And how do both of you outline? Do you use note cards or are you just like in a Word document or like a notepad or anything?
Just a document. Yeah. I don't really do a big hierarchical formal outline. I just need to know what the story is basically. So as long as I'm kind of writing, as long as I understand like the synopsis and the major points of what needs to be hit.
I like Scrivener. I started using that a couple years ago. And this is for, novels and stories. We have our own software that we use in the office. But I think I actually do like kind of the hierarchical structure of that. I think kind of, breaking the book down into chapters and then scenes within those chapters kind of helps keep me on track of like structurally where I am in the story, how long a particular bit of action is taking. And there's always kind of the satisfying moment of, aha, I've finished a scene or I finished a chapter and it's right here. And I can move it around very easily if I find that it needs to go somewhere else. I think some of that fiddly stuff for me is as much a sort of method of productive procrastination as anything. Like it kind of gives me something to do while I'm trying to figure out, where all the story and character bits go and, what's missing in the story. I feel like sometimes I'll end up making kind of the same lists and the same outlines and, charting out the same plot points a few different times. Not because I don't have that information, just because I need to play with it more to figure out where everything else goes.
Right. When you're outlining, is there a certain threshold you try to hit for you, like when you move from outline to actually going down the writing? Because Nick and I have different levels where Nick wants to be as complete as possible before he commits to actually going to the writing, where I get the sense of what I want, and then I start doing it knowing that I'll probably throw away some of it anyway.
I'm probably somewhere between the two. Like I always like to have as much detail as I can. Because for me, sort of the most frustrating bit is hitting another chapter, another scene and thinking, oh, wait, I know the characters are supposed to go from A to B here, but why are they doing this? And how are they doing that? And what are they talking about or doing that's interesting while they're making this transition? So I like to have all that detail when I can, but sometimes I've just tried to start realizing when I'll hit a point when I'm outlining or planning and I find that I'm just sort of getting frustrated and just sort of writing down or thinking up the same ideas and the same progressions. And then I think, okay, this is probably the point at which I need to start writing and I've got enough information to probably figure the rest out as I go. So it's become a little more of an organic process. And I think I used to think that the, kind of going back and forth between outlining and drafting was sort of a flaw in my process that stemmed from not outlining well enough. But I think I've made peace with the fact that that is probably just my process and I'm just going to have to deal with the back and forth.
Yeah. Is that the same for you, Matt?
I think as you get a little bit more experience, you maybe get a little bit better at recognizing like what are problems that you don't have to solve right now that you can solve on the page. And what are things you really need to think through before you start laying down words? I used to throw away tons and tons of stuff. I would write whole scenes that didn't work because I didn't think the whole thing through. So, I mean, that's getting back to why I started outlining in the first place. But like my first few kind of forays into fiction, I was throwing away like easily more than half of the actual writing that I had done because I was writing whole scenes and chapters of things that actually didn't make sense and that I had to, take away and completely rewrite. And lately I'm throwing away less. And I think that's probably a better because I'm a little bit more aware of like where things need to go and not completely going down, like spending lots of time wandering around in eddies of stuff that don't actually, that won't be fruitful in the end.
And we talked about trying to like maintain momentum, but when like you lose all your writing momentum or like if you take a break and you aren't able to write, but you come back and try to get into a groove, do you have any like strategies or things you try to help yourself? Like, I know some, what I've tried to do is there are like writing exercises where like try to reframe a scene in this way or jumble around the structure and try to help get your memory going or your brain going.
I think for me, sometimes a change of scenery can be really useful. One of the nice things about moving from Houston to Southern California is that it feels really good to be outside most of the year. And so, whether it's just kind of sitting outside in the area where I live or kind of, you know, going down to the neighborhood Starbucks, I find that sometimes when I'm stuck, just, you know, moving around and even just finding a new place to write can put me in a new frame of mind to start writing.
What about you, Matthew?
Yeah, the same. I think maybe trying to do things that you haven't done before sometimes helps get things started in your brain. You know, if you like go to a play or just do something that you wouldn't that's not normal for you. Go to some weird, like go to your local amateur pro wrestling match. It's just something that's like a little bit out of the blue that can really jolt your brain and give you something to work with.
I've also found that sometimes the stress of wanting to create when I'm not feeling creative can stop me more than anything else. And so, I think just for me, finding a little more discipline about getting some quiet time, whether it's just, you know, a few quiet moments before I sit down to start writing in the morning or a little bit of meditation, just something to kind of let go of the stress and clear my mind out a little bit and kind of let myself approach the process as something I enjoy doing and not something that I'm worried about doing.
The most important question now, do both of you enjoy writing?
I don't think I would do it if I didn't enjoy it. So I guess I would say, yes, I do enjoy it. Even though it's frustrating sometimes, right? I think in the end, yes, I do enjoy it.
Yeah, I enjoy writing when I'm actually writing. I think when I think I don't enjoy writing is when I'm staring at the screen and trying to write. So it's another one of those, I guess, productivity begets productivity. And, you know, the more that I feel that something, you know, interesting and productive is coming of my writing, the happier I am with it. I think it's when I get, you know, when I kind of get very intermittent or, you know, fall out of practice a little bit or, you know, kind of lose track of my schedule that I start to feel more frustrated with it.
So what's the writing process at Obsidian like? Because there's not a lot out there about it. Is there a writer's room?
So the writer's room, there's an office that I share with Eric Fenstermaker, who's the narrative lead. And that pretty much ends up being one of us will turn around and say, oh, hey, let's talk about this thing for a second. I guess we don't really have a writer's room in the same sense as like a TV show. A lot of times what we'll do is we'll maybe, you know, brainstorm big picture ideas, like maybe a quest story or kind of a factions, you know, story and progression or a companion arc or the narrative for a particular area in the game. Or we'll troubleshoot a specific issue like, oh, hey, the progression for this, you know, companion arc feels really fast and this, you know, point gets glossed over or this quest feels predictable or that NPC feels a little dull. But I guess once we have kind of the big picture stuff sort of talked out or set out somewhere, most of the writing, I think, is generally more independent. The writing will be tasked out to somebody and that person will do the writing. And again, unless there's really an issue to troubleshoot, what we'll do most often is, you know, get a draft done, you know, get something basically finished and then take a look at it for feedback and then revisions and iterations.
How does the big picture stuff get decided on? Are there scheduled meetings where everyone comes to, or is it more as problems arise and people come together and meet?
So we'll usually try to do some more informal development as the narrative team I think we always like to try to have a good, complete, cohesive document put together before we take it to the rest of the team. And so, like, if there's a story outline we want, you know, or a particular quest, you know, proposal that we're submitting, like, you know, we think this is, this would be a good story for this quest. And, you know, we'll, I think the rule is to try to get that stuff ironed out as completely as possible as the narrative team, as the writers, so that then when you bring that to the larger team, I think, you know, you can focus on the most meaningful questions. I think when those meetings become less productive is when it's like, well, there's this aspect here that we clearly haven't really figured out or haven't thought about, but we'll figure it out later, because then you spend, you know, the entire meeting trying to figure that thing out. So yeah, I guess the early stages of brainstorming, I think, tend to be more informal and fluid. And then it's, you know, when you try to bring, when you bring the rest of the team in, to try to really move forward with the design, that you have, you know, formal scheduled meetings, but that's also when you want to have your details laid out really well, because, you know, you are making use of everyone else's time. And I think, you know, as the room gets bigger, it's easier for people to, it's easier for people to end up going off in different directions if there are holes in the material that you're proposing.
Yeah. Matthew, so when you were a producer, like, were you overseeing the story and the writing in your job?
I was, yeah. Writing was one of the areas of responsibility that I did have for some of the games that I worked on, like Halo Reach and Halo Chronicles.
So what was, like, working in studios that big, what was it like working with those departments?
I mean, to be honest, it can be pretty frustrating, because there's a lot of different people with a lot of different, very strong ideas about what the story should be and how to make the story work with all of this other work that's going on, that happens with or without the writer's involvement. So, you know, like, people will be designing levels where you go around and you do this or you do that, and then the writers have to sort of adapt that into the larger flow of the story in some way. So it can be a little bit hectic just trying to keep track of all of the things that are in the air and all of the, like, the dependencies, teams depending on one another, and still trying to make something that feels creatively singular, like there was one specific idea that the team wanted to go for. So yeah, I mean, it was a good experience for me. I saw a lot and learned a lot. But I think a lot of the criticisms that people have about AAA are definitely founded in reality. You know, it can be somewhat frustrating and difficult sometimes.
Do you think it was, when you were a producer, do you think it was getting better, or was it just staying the same, like the problems that you had?
I believe that it's pretty much the same. I talk to people who work in these kinds of positions now, and they have similar kinds of frustrations. So I'm not sure that things are necessarily getting better, like, in aggregate. I think that they are better on some teams and they're worse on other teams, right? And it depends on the game, and it depends on the team.
So are the common, like, bottlenecks just the scale of, like, there are so many people, then people making decisions that other people don't know about?
That's a huge one, yeah. Like, there are tons and tons of things that of, like, someone has an idea, but kind of rolling that idea out to the rest of the team is going to be very difficult. And people don't always see how everything fits together because they care about their one piece of the game that they're working on. So it gets very difficult to contain the entire, like, all of the creative decisions that are being made at any one time, especially when you have a team of hundreds of people, all of whom are making decisions about, like, how things look or where you go in the game or what the mechanics of the game will be. And keeping that in mind, along with all of this narrative stuff and all of this story stuff, is just, it just doesn't happen in the most smooth way oftentimes.
And it feels like there's a paradox with documentation sometimes, because the solution that I see or hear a lot of times is, well, you know, we need to make sure these things are all written down. But then that can result in, you know, so much documentation and, well, has everybody read it? Is everybody reading it as it gets updated? You know, are different ideas put forth in different places? So, I mean, it seems like even when you're, even when you're trying to be very specific about documenting everything and rolling it out, based on just the volume of information, I think even then, getting people on the same page can be very tough.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, the documentation can be out of date. People don't mm-hmm. always keep it up to date. People, like you said, people don't read it sometimes. Or people want to question it anyway, just because the document says that, like, this thing is this way. People will be like, yeah, but it doesn't really have to be that way, does it? Come on.
You know, right.
So.
Do you have any ideas on how you would solve this? Is it solvable?
I don't know. I mean, there are different ways that people in the industry talk about, like, how an ideal, very large team would work. Some people say it would be best if you worked out everything. One of the problems is that if you have a 100 person team, they're all working all at once on the game. And so some people I've talked to have said, you know, it would be great if we worked out the entire design of the game, in like this sort of gray box form with all of the narrative beats all set up and it all works. And then at the very end, 100 artists come in and just make it look really pretty. And then there's no arguing and back and forth on, like, does this have to be this way or does this have to be that way? The artists don't really contribute in any way backwards. It's just make this all look pretty, which is kind of an interesting way to propose it. But it also, you know, that also removes the contribution that artists do make when they are involved, or any of the other teams. Like, sometimes people will come up with a very good idea because they're all involved and they're all engaged. So I'm not sure that there is necessarily, or at least that I can think of, there isn't like one way out there to solve it. It's really just anytime you have this many people, like, really making these kinds of decisions all together, it is going to be a little bit, it's going to be a very complex situation. And just managing that is just a matter of, you know, how much the team trusts each other, how well they work together, and the pressures that the team is under and factors like that.
Yeah, the teams I've worked on for Pillars and the expansions have been quite a bit smaller. But yeah, I feel like maybe a good mix of formal and informal meetings, and having producers who are, you know, who are up to date with what everybody else on the team is doing in a way that the rest of the individual team members may not have the time to be, you know, and having those producers, you know when dots need to be connected, know when, you know, one person needs to, you know, talk to another person, you know, as in addition to having just sort of a good schedule of meetings about specific blocks of content, you know, that bring narrative and area design and art all together, you know, in one room so that everybody can be on the same page. And then, you know, I think kind of like Matthew was talking about, you know, just having a good dynamic, having a team in which people are comfortable just, I think, walking into one another's office and saying like, oh, hey, this is a thing I'm working on and I notice it's related to a thing you're working on. Why don't you tell me about what you're working on right now? And having people take the initiative to connect with one another and make sure that, you know, everyone's working on the same game.
Right. How big is the team at the Pillars of Eternity team at Obsidian?
I think at different times it fluctuated between probably about 25 and 35 people.
Oh, wow. That's smaller than I thought. And so you still had problems with people not knowing everything that everyone else is working on?
I mean, not in a super massive sense. I think more what happens is assumptions are made about content. Like, you know, and everything, ideally, you know, content is iterative. And, you know, maybe you start with one idea and there are five different directions you can take it. And two people may be working in one direction and another person may be working in a different direction. And so, you know, getting people kind of moving in the same direction, on the same page about changes, and especially when, I mean, it was a lot of content for a relatively small team. And yes. I think it is easy at that point to say, you know, we don't necessarily have time to you know, sit down around a table and work all this stuff out in the detail and at, you know, the length that we'd like. So we need to just move full steam ahead and just get this stuff done.
Right. Okay, and So with Pillars of Eternity, what did being a spiritual successor to games like Baldur's Gate and Icewind Dale mean writing-wise? And were you ever worried about going too far with it or being too faithful?
So I think from a narrative perspective, we wanted to follow kind of the scope of the story and the flavor of the world rather than the style of the writing or the plot points of Baldur's Gate and Icewind Dale. I think tonally and stylistically, there were some pretty big differences that we were deliberate about. I think there's a sense of wackiness in Baldur's Gate that wasn't really what we were going for. But what we did want to do was give the player this magical fantasy world and a story that explores it. And we definitely had kind of a range of tastes on the team, from people who preferred very traditional things to people who prefer novelty and new territory. And so I think having a fair bit of diversity in that sense, people tended to balance one another out. I think with a spiritual successor, the thing is always, you know, we're not trying to remake this game. We're trying to make something that makes you feel the same wonder and amazement that you felt when you played this game years and years ago.
Yeah. Just before you go into another series of questions with Matthew, I was just curious, like, has being a producer, did that give you, like, did it inform your work as a writer at all or help you in ways you didn't really expect?
Certainly it does. Production is in many ways about kind of trying to get people to work together and human problems. So in addition to the problems of like kind of scheduling and resource management and tracking dependencies and things like that, which are maybe a little bit more technical, there's a tremendous human component to production, right? That you want to think about how teams work together and how teams split apart and how people start fighting with each other and what kinds of personalities work and what kinds of personalities like grade on each other and what kinds of situations you can put people in so that they're productive and enjoy their work, right? So all of these kinds of things you can do with your characters too in a story, right? Like you can put people with different characters with different personalities together and think about how they play off each other. And to me, that's definitely related to the work that I did as a producer. And certainly my time as a producer, you know, has informed the stuff that I write today.
And one of your interviews, you said that you got into the industry to create a total work of art. What does that mean? And how close do you think you've come to achieving it?
Yeah. Yeah, there's this German word, the Gesamtkunstwerk, which means the total work of art. And Richard Wagner, the composer, used this word a couple times to talk about what he was trying to do with opera. And to me, games are a great like medium for sort of exploring this concept because games have they integrate a lot of different disciplines, right? So when you think about a game, you're thinking about the mechanics of the game and the game design. You're thinking about the art of the game and the sounds and the narrative design and all of these things come together. All of these different disciplines, which are great and huge disciplines on their own, come together to create this, hopefully, a work of art. I would say I have not created anything like that. So not at all. I don't think I'm anywhere close, actually. I would love to in the future, but it's kind of a distant goal for me at this point, right? Like thinking about having that much, like that many resources available and the ability to really integrate those on such a level is not a level that I think that I'm at right now.
Have your goals like changed from what you're wanting to do?
I mean, not really. I still dream of like the big, cool thing that's big and cool. So I guess in that sense, the goals haven't changed, but it's tough to get there with the industry being the way that it is. I think I just have to continue, you know, keep working on the things that I believe in.
Do you have a similar goal, Carrie, for like what you're trying to achieve?
I think the total work of art is definitely a really lofty and admirable goal. And I think that's probably, I hope at least, what a lot of us would like to create. I think for me, sort of kind of managing my expectations and my understanding about, like, you know, recognizing that what I can do is only one part of the project. And so, you know, even my contributions will be better and the game will be better if I'm, you know, working in concert with the rest of the team. And if I understand, you know, what everybody's goals are and, you know, use my writing and story building as part of that process and is something that, you know, hopefully augments the work that everybody else is doing and not as its own element, if that makes sense.
Totally does. This is a more process question, and it's for both of you, but Carrie, you can answer first. With games where the player has a lot of choices to determine the story and what happens in it, how do you balance giving the player an experience that feels unique and tailored to them with a desire to tell a coherent story?
I guess there are three main things that I try to think about to accomplish this, but still keep scope within reason. So the first, I think, is offering decisions that lead to choke points. Now, this can be done very badly, and it can become very transparent if you've got, like, these wildly divergent directions where you insult someone and they say, oh, you've got a lot of nerve, and then they say, well, anyway, about that quest we were talking about. But I think when it's subtle and believable, it can give the player a chance to interact with characters in a small but personal way. And so I think you just have to be very deliberate about where you design them and, you know, how you branch and flow from those. Second thing is, I think that even in a linear story, creating motivations that are compelling for the player will help it feel personal, even if you can't author, you know, five different directions for, you know, the third act of the game. If you've told the kind of story that is effectively motivating, I think that will help you work within the constraints that are, you know, that are foisted upon you. I think perhaps one of the biggest differences between writing novels and writing games is that when you're writing a novel, you can compel an authored protagonist through any means that you devise that are coherent and consistent with their character and consistent with, you know, the problems that the world throws at them. But in games, your audience is your protagonist most often. And so you have to think about ways to motivate the player, I think, on a variety of levels, to get them interested and invested in the story that you're creating for them. And I think the last thing is that reactivity to a player's choices and class and disposition, even if these things are not enormous, I think when they are present, they can be very meaningful. And even a relatively, like when you look at the overall percentage of content, even a relatively small amount of this stuff can go a long way if it is present and recognizable for the player. And this can be something as simple as having NPCs approach the player and pitch a quest differently. Like someone says they want you to steal something and they reference the fact that you've got a reputation for being very deceptive or you're a thief or a rogue or you've done this other quest that's relevant. Now it could be that they were going to pitch this quest to you anyway, but the experience can still feel reactive if you're able to, you know, look at what the player's done and kind of cast this approach and this relationship in terms of the player's own choices.
I'm still thinking about your talking about how the audience is the protagonist in games and why certain motivations or character actions won't work if they're just from the character's point of view. And it makes a lot of sense. I never thought of it that way. And I think that's why a lot of certain games and storylines don't strike a chord with players, but they aren't able to articulate why.
Yeah. Like I think one of the things that, you know, people sort of shrug off the most is, you know, you've got a relationship that is very important to your character, but that the player playing that character has no real investment in. And so it's like, this is your spouse or this is your child. You really want to save them. And it's like, actually, I kind of want to go exploring over here, you know?
Yeah.
And I think in an RPG in particular, kind of the expectations are multiplied because it's like, well, you've told me I can play any character I want. I don't really care about saving this village. Like, give me a better reason to do this. And so I think sometimes you end up creating, and I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing, but trying to create a range of reasons that will appeal to a variety of different types of players. So, you know, for players who want to be the hero, you know, here's an evil and here's what you can do about it. For players who are, you know, very practically self-interested, you know, here's a material reward that you will get from doing this. For players who are just interested in a very good story, here's an interesting cast of characters and a problem with some interesting plot twists that is compelling to you. So I think you just try to look at a lot of different layers of interest so that you can speak to as many players as possible without feeling that you're, you know, just offering token motivations for any of those things.
Yeah. It seem like that video games would require a lot more setup time than like novels would to establish all of that. Or I guess it depends on the execution.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose. I guess one thing is like, I feel like the world building side of game is even bigger in games than it is in novels. Yeah. There's this concept of negative space in the arts, and you know, in physical arts, like, you know, your negative space is your background and the empty space and the space around your subjects, and your positive space, is the figures in your painting or, you know, the shape of your sculpture. And I feel like in games, you know, a lot of times what we do is we give players this really big negative space to play around in. And that's what defines their experience as much as, and maybe more than, you know, sometimes the characters and the big plots and these things. But I think that gives you a freedom to, again, especially in like a large RPG, to build these things a bit slowly. I hope that answers your question. I forgot exactly where I was going with this.
Okay. No, it makes sense. Matthew, do you have anything else to add about this when it comes to like balancing player agency and the desire to tell a coherent story?
Not really. I actually think that was a great answer. Most of the stuff that I've worked on, like as a producer, a lot of the things I did were first person shooters, and so they have very linear stories. And then the stuff that I've worked on for myself, they're also pretty linear. The Arboretum and The Writer Will Do Something, which are my two Twine games, are actually quite linear. So I don't have as much experience actually with that, you know, trying to find that balance.
Did that ever come up in like your role as a producer, like in the teams you worked on, or there was just like not an issue for them
of trying to be like more dynamic about stuff? In an action game like an FPS, the dynamic stuff really comes out from the moment to moment dialogue. There's a whole moment to moment dialogue system when you're in a battle, right? Like someone, like you throw a grenade and you hear the enemies say grenade or whatever. Yeah. Like that kind of stuff is a completely dynamic system. So, but it's also pretty self-contained. You don't have to react to the player making a tremendously important choice and write all these different dialogue, like things to cover like these different events or things like that.
Since you brought up your Twine games, for people who don't know, The Writer Will Do Something is about you are a writer of a fictional game at the AAA studio and problems happen. But how did that game come about?
So I had sent my friend Tom a copy of my previous Twine game, The Arboretum, and he was like, oh, we should write a Twine together. I think that would be fun. And so one of us, I believe, suggested a game about being a writer on a game. And Tom has worked on several games in the past as well as the writer. And I had worked as the producer. Part of what I was doing was managing the writing team. So we kind of decided that we would write a game where you are the writer of a big AAA game. And from there, we just sort of ramped it up and dialed it up. So now it's like the game is completely in trouble and you have to try to save the game from having really bad reviews in this one meeting. with people who are all extremely angry at each other and angry at the situation that they're in. So we kind of took that seed of the idea and just dialed it up to 11 and made it very harrowing experience.
Yeah, I played that. Sorry, if you don't mind me asking. I played it a couple times and got a couple different outcomes. I was curious, did you have one in mind that you thought was the win or the best outcome?
No, not really. We were actually kind of thinking that all three are sort of not winning. Like you,
yeah,
either,
that's what it felt like.
You either stay at the bad studio and continue in this bad situation, or you leave and then you like you're writing ad copy, and that's like not even that's not that much better. So, yeah, there are three endings, and all three are pretty ambiguous and don't represent any kind of like escape or transcendence or anything like that.
Like, I'm curious, Carrie, like what your reaction to it was, because when we played it, it was a lot of like heavy sighing from our parts and just like, oh God, no, I know exactly what this feels like.
Yeah, I don't think I've had those specific experiences by any means. I think I've actually been pretty fortunate to have, you know, started at a studio that does have a pretty big narrative focus, and then that does feel that good narrative is important. And to be on, you know, a somewhat smaller team, I think, where it was, you know, easier to interact with everybody, you know, and easy to have, you know, at least sort of a personal understanding, you know, that everybody does want to make this game good, and nobody thinks this stuff is unimportant. But I feel like that's definitely the picture I had heard of game development and writing for games as, you know, being just a very hectic process where even winning doesn't really look like winning. So I had a lot of sympathy for that situation nonetheless.
Yeah, to be fair, we did really kind of concentrate all of the bad things into this one like meeting with these handful of characters. It's not that we really think that it's always this bad. We just wanted to like make it this incredibly concentrated, incredibly like strongly felt thing about that kind of frustration and about that specific kind of meeting.
Was there a part of making this where like a lot of the problems were like with writers that you could have on a game is stuff that you can't really talk about publicly because of politics and stuff, and like nobody, like other people who work on teams don't really get an idea of what stuff you could deal with. So was making this game trying to like show people how bad it could get and like the stuff you could deal with?
I suppose. I mean, for us, it was just a lot of fun. Yeah. I mean, I think because we had had some of those kinds of frustrations in the past, it was really fun and really easy to just write them in an exaggerated way and put them together into this thing. So our purpose wasn't necessarily to be like, we're going to educate people on how things go, because that, you know, it, like I said, it's exaggerated. It's out there. It's more of like a kind of a firecracker television sort of thing than it is like what things really are like.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think people can maybe glean some sort of insight into how bad things can get and why games don't always succeed on a narrative level.
Have you had any surprising responses from people?
A lot of people say they actually feel real anxiety. Like it really reminds them of a real meeting that they've been in. I think especially the part, and Tom wrote this part, but especially the part where like everyone in the meeting turns to you to like solve all their problems. Like we spend a little bit of time setting up that everything is gone poorly and we need to solve this problem. And then everyone in the meeting, they all just look at you like, how are we going to solve this? And I think that people respond to that pretty well, you know, especially people with experience in this kind of thing.
Has it happened to you or you, Carrie?
Not exactly. I mean, and for one thing, I think it helps being part of a team. You know, like Eric is the narrative lead. And so I guess if it would happen to anybody, it would probably happen to him. But, you know, I think one thing is that we've tended to develop the story alongside the game. And my impression was that a lot of these big, you know, oh, you'll figure something out, you know, kind of moments happen when somebody has, you know, or when a game has been designed with no real attention or, you know, thought about a narrative or a story. And so then it's like, well, we have this, you know, mishmash of levels and mechanics, and the narrative's job is just to string them together, right?
Yeah, that's definite. No, go ahead. Sorry.
No, that was it. I was hoping that you would tell me if that's really kind of how it goes or not.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so the twine is definitely like everything has gone wrong, right? But yeah, it does happen that way. A lot of times a writer, especially an external writer, a writer who's not part of the team, but someone who jets in and is there to like kind of write dialogue and stuff, will be presented with a game that's more or less designed. And then they have to, the writer's job at that point is just to kind of string these things together and to explain, come up with a random explanation for why they're at the next level, which is a desert level. And it's like, oh, well, okay, I guess it's because blah, blah, blah. You know, that's the writer's job in that instance.
Mm-hmm. There was, I think it was maybe an earlier episode of this show. It might have been Kara Ellison was saying something about how, you know, if what your dialogue and what your narrative does is exposition, then, you know, well, of course the dialogues are going to be boring. There needs to be, you know, character and story, which is not the same thing as an A to B to C plot. But yeah, if you're leaning on, you know, narrative and dialogue just to provide, you know, very basic explanations from how you go from one point to the next, it's probably not going to be very satisfying.
Yeah, not at all. And sometimes a lot of these big action games, they're designed that way, right? Like the in what comes first is, oh, it would be cool if you were in a skyscraper that was like falling down while you were in it. And then they go and they do that, right? And then it's like, okay, now explain why the player is doing this. And then inevitably it's always like, oh, we think maybe the bad guy's hideout is in this skyscraper. Oh no, it's not. Oh no, now it's falling. Like it always becomes this really rote, perfunctory, predictable thing because it hasn't, like that hasn't been thought of at the very beginning, right? The very beginning was just like, oh, we should have a boat chase.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then it's like, and the writer will figure out why the boat chase is happening.
There's this thing I always hear, and it always bothers me a little bit. It's, you know, gameplay trumps story. Gameplay is more important than narrative. And it's one of those things that I agree that is technically true in most cases. But if that's the way you look at it, then you're going to do your story a disservice. Because I think you can generally come up with solutions that create both good gameplay and an interesting, coherent story if you decide that both of those elements are worth having. But you'll solve whatever equation you set up for yourself. And so if what you decide is we need to figure out fun gameplay and then let's figure out a story that we can put on top of it, you know, you're going to end up with probably a fun game that doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense or create a lot of emotional investment, you know, with your players. And, you know, furthermore, like gameplay and story are not disparate elements. At the very least, your story is what gives context to your gameplay. And your gameplay is your interaction with your story. And I think that looking at those elements together and developing them side by side can, you know, result, again, in solutions that satisfy, you know, everybody. You just have to make the time to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I want to backtrack just a little bit to when we were talking about informing, like, more of the general public about what happens behind the scenes in the games. I want to ask both of you, should the public be more aware of how games are made and what happens behind the scenes? Like, should they be better informed about the writing process or the creation process? Or should they not know it and it doesn't really matter?
I think critics should know. If you're going to be a writer about games, it's maybe good to know a little bit about how games are made. I don't necessarily think just the public has to know. I mean, what at the end of the day, it's whether they respond to it, right? Whether the end effect is good or not. But if you look at like critics of other media, literary critics or film critics, or even things like restaurant critics. Like, they all have intimate knowledge of their subject, and they know what they're talking about. They don't just only ever talk about the end result. They're also aware of what goes into the product and the creative process, and in many instances they've tried it themselves, right? They're also practitioners.
Right.
So I think to be a good critic, you do need to engage in development in some way, either knowing about it or trying it yourself. But I would say, like, the average consumer, no, it's just about whether they respond to what's, you know, what the end result is or not.
Would you agree, Carrie?
I would. And I guess the other thing I'd add, just as sort of an interesting thing, is, you know, I feel like in other media, we have a stronger awareness and usually an appreciation of kind of the people who create the stuff we like. You know, like, if you generally read books that are by authors you know you like, you go to see movies that are directed by directors you like and that feature actors you like. I mean, the subject matter is part of it as well. But if you're like, oh, this is a Spielberg movie, like, that means something to you. If you say, oh, Neal Stephenson came out with another book, that means something to you. I think Hideo Kojima seems like a rather interesting exception in this, you know, this idea that, you know, sort of games are created by production companies, in that, you know, he is sort of a name brand creator in a way that I feel like few other people are. And I feel like maybe that's a good thing. You know, the other thing is, like, it's an enormous team of people that makes, you know, Metal Gear Solid games, that makes any game, really. And so I know on the one hand that, like, boiling it down to any one person is, you know, potentially a bit misleading. But at the same time, it, you know, I wonder if we wouldn't see a different sort of critical and consumer culture. Not that you want to enforce an awareness of a process on consumers who, you know, as Matthew correctly said, you know, they want a good experience and your job is to just give them a good experience. But what does that say, I wonder, about the way we consume games and the way we look at them on sort of the, you know, entertainment to art spectrum, and, you know, what we think they're capable of.
So, Matthew, I'm going to butcher the name of the game because I forgot how you said it, but you've dealt with relationships and dating with
the Arboretum. Okay, the Arboretum. Usually how we say it, yeah.
And some of your articles. But what do you think about the state of relationships portrayed in games? And do you think it's still, like, too binary?
I guess I do, yeah. Relationships in games, especially larger commercial games, are very, they're usually only ever depicted, even mechanically, or especially mechanically, they're only ever depicted along one axis. There's basically a value in the game somewhere that says how much someone likes you. In Fire Emblem, for example, it's just these ranks, right? Like, you S rank with someone and then you're, like, best buddies. That's measuring a relationship across one dimension of a one dimensional metric, right? It's like how much someone likes you increases from 1 to 100 or something like that. And I really think that relationships in real life go across many dimensions, right? Like, there are times where you may not be able to say in words very well what your relationship to someone is, in fact. I certainly have had times in my life where I don't actually know. Like, there may not even be a word for, like, what this, my relationship to this person is, because it incorporates so many different kinds of feelings. So I feel that, like, one weakness of the way we represent relationships right now is because we do so along this one linear axis of this person likes me or doesn't like me, when in fact, in real life, you can like and hate someone at the same time, or you can, you know, be incredibly frustrated by someone but also attracted to them, and things like that, which I don't think a lot of games have really plumbed that territory very much.
Are there any games that you think have done it well?
not precisely in the way that I'm thinking of. I can't really think of anything. There may be some indie experiments out there that kind of play with this, with these notions. But I've been thinking about like just kind of larger games trying to represent this kind of relationship, which I'm not sure I can think of any that really explore that territory.
Have you experienced any of this, Carrie?
Yeah, I think working in RPGs, you know, romances are something that come up a lot. And like we didn't have any in Pillars. And I think one problem you notice a lot of times is, you know, the linearity that Matthew was describing. You know, and in particular, when you've got like a romance subplot, you know, there's this sense that, you know, you win the romance by getting to the sex at the end. And if you have the sex, that's proof that you have the relationship. And if you don't have sex, then there isn't really a relationship there, which is a very shallow way of looking at it, obviously. And it's also problematic when sort of achieving that end state is something that you do by giving enough gifts and saying enough nice things and doing the quest that the person wants you to do, you know? And it's weird because I understand, you know, this is also a problem still in how some people do look at relationships and entitlement and, you know, sex as currency. And it's a faulty way of looking at it. And it's something that I don't really think we want to recreate in games. You know, but sort of the win state mentality, I think, means that you know, a lot of times you end up with something like that. You know, and you see too, like when you have a romanceable character, it may be your gender determines whether or not they are available to you, but very little else plays in, you know, like unless you start doing just terrible, terrible things, you know, there's always this one point in the conversation where the character is waiting for you to flirt back. And if you flirt back, you know, no matter what else you've done, like no matter if you're, you know, kind of the nice person or, you know, the no nonsense, get things done person, or whether, you know, you tend to be funny or whether you tend to be very sincere, you know, that stuff very rarely factors into whether this other person is interested in you. And so I think it starts to feel a little bit token. And yeah, I agree. It would be nice if we thought of, you know, more complex ways to model relationships, and also ways to model relationships that did not involve saying, you know, relationships are another mechanic that the player needs to win. Instead of, you know, saying instead that, well, they're complex and they're messy and they're somewhat ambiguous, you know? And so like, kind of like the end states of, the writer will do something. Like, it's not about getting to one and thinking, oh yeah, you won, you did it right. It's more like, well, you have different outcomes and that's okay. And that's a lot more interesting than saying, did you solve the dialogue puzzle and say the right things and give the right gifts to get to the sex scene?
Yeah, totally. And I think there's another thing that you said, that I think is really good is like, yeah, that's like oftentimes that's like the end state of the relationship. Like you get to the relationship and then it sort of ends. Like the game doesn't really track anything after that. You are in a relationship and then that is it for forever. More when I think like if you are in a relationship, you know that that's just the beginning. Like starting a relationship with someone is all of the highs and lows come after that point, right? Like now you're in a relationship with someone and all these interesting things happen, which games don't model at all. It's more like you entered the relationship, congratulations, and then everything just kind of shuts down.
Yeah.
You know?
So here's a question for both of you that is not about relationships. But it was a bit of a strange one. When you're working on something and the inevitable practicalities of production hit where you're forced to alter your plans and change things that might not be to your liking, and then the finished product is released, how do you think about it? Like, do you think about it in its final form, or do you focus on the missed opportunities, the might have beens, and all that?
I try to look at the bigger picture. I mean, it always kind of hurts to think about the things you wanted to do, but that you didn't have the opportunity to do or the resources or the time to do. But, you know, I try to focus on the stuff that you did do that came out really well and that you can take pride in and, you know, build from. One bit of writing advice that you hear a lot is kill your darlings. And, you know, the, fact is there are just some great ideas that don't fit or that don't fit right now. But those are often things that you can use later. And furthermore, when it gets to the point in production where you have to cut something, you're usually so pressed for time that realizing, okay, you know what, I wanted to do this, but I really don't have to now. Like, we don't have time and I don't have to. That can be a relief. And I think that's a time to embrace the content that you are still working on and have the opportunity to make it that much better rather than sort of partially implementing something you really wanted to do, but not having time to polish it properly.
Would you agree, Matthew?
Yeah, definitely. I think, as you know, having worked as a producer, you're a little bit more detached from some of the creative decisions that happen, and so it's a little bit easier to have some distance from things. I will also sort of hopefully diplomatically say that, like, the story for games like Halo that I worked on are a little bit easier for me to detach from, because I don't personally respond to that kind of story incredibly strongly.
Yeah.
So if decisions are made on the story of, like, what happens in the next Halo game or the next Call of Duty game, I don't have a tremendous amount of remorse over, like, what could have been. Like, you know, this Call of Duty game could have been, like, so amazingly, like, strong emotionally. Like, I haven't had to really be in a situation like that.
Yeah. And this is somewhat related, and it's a question that I have no idea what the answer is, so I'm really curious to hear what both of you say. After, like, a game comes out and there's a critical discussion starting, should the creators ever be involved? Like, people were saying or debating whether or not something was intentional in the story when you know it was. Can you speak up, or are you just supposed to let it be out there and have people debate it and discuss it themselves?
That's a really interesting question.
Yeah.
I feel like it's probably going to be a longer discussion than you really have the stamina or time for. At least that's my perspective. I think maybe sometimes there are particular ideas and issues that on a personal level you really want to engage with about as a creator, and I think that's probably fine. But I think the discussion is going to move a lot faster than you can. And so, you know, I think hoping to, you know, enforce a particular point of view or idea is probably pretty fruitless. I think it can be, you know, helpful sometimes to address and learn from, you know, certain criticisms or ideas, like, you know, maybe representation and inclusivity. If questions about that come up, I think that can be, you know, a useful experience perhaps. But I certainly don't think there's any obligation or even reason to tell people, like, what the game meant or what you meant. Because I think the fun in, you know, any artistic or entertainment medium is letting people learn, you know, discover and find their own meanings.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's okay to sort of maybe say, here's what we were going for, or here's why, you know, here's what we were trying to do. But in a way that's just sort of leaving it out there for people to find if they want to see, and not necessarily responding to other people and saying, like, oh, you're interpreting my work wrong. Like, that's just an exercise in futility. People are going to interpret your work how they want to interpret it. And it's not really contributing anything to the conversation for you to, like, jump in and say, no, what it actually means is this, because I'm the creator and I say, like, I get to be blah, 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 because that's kind of not necessarily what the critics are talking about. They're talking about what it means to them, or what they're talking about, how to place your work in the context of the larger kind of culture and where things are going. So I would say engagement with the audience, if they ask you, like, what were you thinking when you made this? Like, that's fine. You can say it, but I don't think, like, entering into arguments of saying, like, you're interpreting my work wrong. Like, that's not really useful.
You can say your intent without discounting what other people take away from it.
That's right.
So we've been talking more about process and stuff, about, like, actually working as writers and working in industry, but with games in general, do you either of you, like, are there problems with storytelling with games right now for both of you? And
I would say that a couple things. One is like the things that we were talking about a little bit earlier, like the complexity of relationships and things like that. I don't think necessarily have been explored as well as they could be in a lot of cases. And I think that we're maybe starting to think a lot more about representation and things like that. There's certainly a lot more work to do there. And we want, as a medium, to be a strong medium, we have to be able to tell all kinds of different stories and encapsulate a lot of different aspects of what it means to be a human being. But right now, there's still a pretty good amount of resistance in, like, AAA, for example, to that kind of exploration and also experimentation. So I would say, you know, we really need to continue to push on those things in order to make the medium worthwhile, just as an aggregate.
Yeah, I agree completely. I feel like one of the big buzzwords right now is ludonarrative dissonance, which I guess for listeners is the idea that the gameplay and the story send different messages. And I feel like that seems to pop up more in a lot of games where, you know, the primary mechanic is shooting people, but the story says that you're, you know, a fundamentally good or noble or basically decent person rather than a deranged killer. And I don't really know how you solve that problem exactly. I've seen it lampshaded a lot, not really answered. But it's, you know, I feel like that's an interesting example of, you know, a mechanic, you know, combat that is just so common that I feel like for a lot of players, it is, you know, divorced from, you know, the kind of meaning it would have in almost any other medium. You know, it's like you sort of loosely, you know, health bar, you associate that with health, you know, shooting stuff is the mechanic. So yeah, I don't really know what the answer to that is, other than, you know, also, you know, looking at other ways for the player to interact with the world and with the characters.
When it comes to ludonarrative dissonance, do you feel like video games get a more critical eye with that than other forms of media? Because it seems like they do to me.
I mean, I feel like there's always been a little bit of that moral panic of, oh, people are playing video games and they're so violent. Does that make people violent? Yeah, I feel like they do get a bit more criticism than, you know, violent movies and, you know, certainly violent or horrific books. I don't think that criticism is, you know, necessarily justified. There's a metaphor that I heard from Stephen King that's really nice, and it's, you know, about feeding your alligators, you know, and saying we all have, you know, basements full of alligators, and, you know, sometimes you got to just go down there and, you know, throw some meat at them. Like, we all have this stuff is cathartic, and that's okay. And, you know, enjoying catharsis does not, you know, make you a, you know, fundamentally violent person by any means.
Yeah,
I think other media have outlets for this kind of thing. Like, they have genre that's understood to be genre. And I think maybe one of the things why we've gotten in trouble with this with games is because we have certain games that are really held up as shining examples of, like, really good storytelling with tremendous ludonarrative dissonance problems, like Uncharted, for example. Uncharted is sort of my go-to example of, like, they're really good in a lot of aspects. And then there's these long gameplay sections where you really are just killing, like, people over and over and over again. Like, if that were to be a movie, it would really make no sense at all. Like, if you were really going to depict everything that went on in an Uncharted game in a movie, right? Yeah. I think if they made an Uncharted movie, the body count would be much, much lower than what you see in Uncharted the game. So I think if games come in for this type of criticism a lot, it's partially because of this weird kind of disconnect between what we uphold as like the best of our medium versus what in movies would be kind of a genre movie, like a genre action movie.
And backtrack a bit to talk about like AAA studios now experimenting more with the potentials of storytelling and like the games that they want to do. What do you think will it take for them to actually experiment more? Because it feels like what will happen, just one game will do it, it'll become really successful, then everyone will try to copy it.
Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily the most sustainable way to create that kind of innovation and encourage that. I really think that just having a more diverse team that makes the game is really the way to create stuff that pushes, you know, pushes things further. I've seen the effect of a more diverse team just kind of in operation, and it that's the thing that really works, I think.
Okay.
Instead of just like saying we have to innovate, like think of new stuff. Like you can't just tell your old team like just think of new things. You really have to get people in there who are thinking in a different way.
That doesn't stop people from trying, though.
No. I mean, and it's good to explore new things, whether or not the team is new or not. But I personally believe that, like, you know, increasing the diversity of experience of people on your team is the best way to get there.
I think also perhaps paradoxically, having more modest budgets can free teams up to experiment more.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think when you're spending, you know, so much money on producing and especially on marketing the game, you know, there's this idea that, well, we have to meet this basic threshold for the game to have been profitable. And so therefore we're going to kind of steer things in the safest, most broadly appealing way we can to ensure that, you know, everybody buys our game, because it looks, you know, safe or just sort of generally appealing. And then, you know, yeah, doing something new, trying something interesting or novel, sort of falls by the wayside because it becomes a risk.
Yeah. What media are you two consuming right now? Like books, video games, movies, etc.?
So I've been reading the Expanse series. So I'm on the fourth book right now, which is called Cibola Burn. It's sort of a moderately near future science fiction series about colonization of the solar system and lots of other interesting stuff that's really fantastic. There was a really good TV series on sci-fi that my husband and I watched and really, really loved. I've been playing King of Dragon Pass and 80 Days on my iPhone. Ooh. And Broforce and just recently Fallout 4 on PS4. We just finished playing the Uncharted series and Far Cry 4. And I'm really trying to get my better half to give season 4 of The Wire a shot. We've got the first episode problem right now, which is every season is about something else. And so you go from the streets to the docks, you're like, no, I want to go back to the streets. But you just have to get through that first episode, and then it's all fantastic.
But you do go back to the streets eventually. You see everyone again.
You do. And then the problem now is in season 4, it's at the schools. And I think my husband knows in his mind that it will be just as good as all of the other seasons. But he feels in his heart that he cannot invest in this as much as in the streets or the docks.
Isn't 4 the one everyone loves?
I don't know. I'm going to tell him that, though.
Yeah. Is that everything, Carrie?
Pretty much, yeah.
And Matthew?
I guess the big game that I just kind of wrapped up playing was Assassin's Creed Syndicate, which was fun. I really liked running around Victorian London. That was a cool experience. And then reading-wise... I just finished reading the Neapolitan novels by Elena Ferrante. There's a series of 4 novels tracing this woman's friendship with another woman in Naples, in Italy, from maybe the 60s through the current day. It's a cool series of novels. It's really interesting. I personally would... like game developers to read these because they are about systems in a lot of ways. I mean, they're about a lot of things, but one of the things that the novels do a very good job of tracing is kind of like where the systemic origins of people being terrible to each other can come from. And so there's decay in society and in the government, and there's misogyny built into the culture, and there's other sort of conditions that create the events that happen in the novels.
This is a good chance for follow-up where you could add to another book if you want to this question, Matthew. But for Carrie, are there any books you would recommend to game developers to help with that you think would help with development, but they aren't about like making games?
This isn't exactly a book. But we've been talking about telling more personal stories. Now and then I really like to listen to the Moth Radio Hour. It's basically just storytellers telling stories about things that have happened to them. And it is way more interesting than I ever thought something like that could be. And I think, some of these stories end up being very interesting because they are inherently about very unusual events. And sometimes it's just that the person telling the story has, it's fairly mundane by comparison, but the person has such a unique voice or perspective or sense of humor about everything. And I think that can be, a great way to look at, character development and relationship development and even just the development of voice, and a sense of perspective for characters. So I'll say that since I'm still trying to think of a specific book to answer your question.
That works, though. We'll put it in the show notes.
I think I would recommend a book that shows the possibilities of like fantasy or science fiction that don't necessarily fall into like these really well-worn fantasy / science fiction kind of areas that we've already explored a lot. I see sometimes people complain that like games are pretty much Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, and Aliens just all kind of mushed into together. So I would recommend maybe the writer Karen Russell is one that springs to mind. She writes these short stories that take place in a very interesting world. She's done a lot of like the world building in these short stories. They all take place in the same world. Is very interesting. It's kind of this magical realist sort of infused place. One of her short story collections is called St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves. And they're easy to read, and they do a great job with world building. And I would recommend game developers read these kinds of stories and think about how worlds can be built that are magical and very interesting, that don't necessarily depend on the tropes that we've seen so far so commonly.
That's great. Carrie, did you think of anything else? Otherwise, the Moth one is good.
I really like the fiction of China and Mieville. And I think for some of the reasons, Matthew was stating, like it's fantastic world building. And they're very dense in terms of sort of both, plot and character and sort of the, factional interests. But I do think that they avoid a lot of the typical kind of good guy, bad guy tropes. And I think the motives can be very, very interesting and nicely complex too. So I would certainly recommend his series. I guess it's the Boslog trilogy. It's Perdido Street Station, The Scar, and Iron Council, for some really great storytelling with fantastic and really, really fun world building, kind of somewhat darker sensibility, and also some very complex characters and situations that, I don't think really get reduced or simplified in, a lot of the ways you might see elsewhere. They're really well done.
Perfect.
All right, I think we're going to wrap it up now. So, for both of you, where can people find you on the internet?
Sure. My Twitter handle is Mr. Wasteland, all one word. And my website is magicalwasteland.com, all together. And all my stuff is there.
On Twitter, I'm Carrie_Patel. And my infrequently updated blog and website is electronicinkblog.com.
Cool. And you can find this podcast on Twitter at ScriptLockCast. And thank you both for coming.
This was wonderful.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks a bunch. This was great.